This time of year, expectations are high. And in the technology industry, it's a new chance to make your quirky little innovation the next big thing. Maybe 2015 is the moment for a futuristic refrigerator.
You know, when you think about it, a connected refrigerator isn't actually a horrible idea. How many times are you at the grocery store and wondering, oh, do we have yogurt or not?
I'm Tanya English, in this week for Mike and Scott, and this is The Pulse. Stories at the heart of health, science, and innovation.
So here's this population that never gets studied, responding dramatically at high rates very, very quickly.
We wanted to actually measure exactly what was going on in the light.
Brains are complex systems of connections modulated by connections.
You are the only person in history of mankind.
And he used Lego Mindstorms to build something called
a tangent. Constantly refreshing the screen, looking at
us. There were chemical ones scary out of it.
Dr. Harris, room 9 now, please.
On today's show, the doctor will see you now. But wait, who's that in the corner taking notes? Plus, an anatomy lesson that started 500 years ago. But first up, buzz. It's that fleeting thing in the world of technology. Products that are supposed to change everything often don't. And if you need proof, just ask an 8-track. For 20 years, one research group has tried to measure all that hype and predict how long it takes to go from breakthrough to blockbuster. Todd Bookman reports.
The tech industry has a habit of getting ahead of itself. An idea comes along, investors talk it up, the media catches wind. Suddenly, the thing is everywhere. But before you can say the word disruptive, doubt creeps in, haters start hating, and the bubble is burst.
Welcome to the Gartner Conferencing Center.
People at Gartner, a Connecticut-based research and consulting firm, spend a lot of their time thinking about that cycle. They put out a chart each year, in fact, called the hype cycle, that tries to measure what stage different technologies are in and how fast they'll move through those stages.
Your inquiry call is about to begin.
Hi, this is Hung Lahong from Gartner.
We called up Lahong, one of the analysts at Gartner, to serve as tour guide. Before we get rolling, it's important to note the cycle isn't round like a circle. It's more serpentine.
The shape of the curve, if you can imagine it, it rises up like a mountain peak in the beginning to describe the fact that this technology is quite exciting.
Gartner calls this first phase the innovation trigger. On the upward slope, you'll find not quite yet household name technologies like bioacoustic sensing and volumetric displays. Another, human augmentation, is also still flying under the radar, but won't be for long.
Since the age of 21, instead of seeing color, I can hear color.
This is artist Neil Harbison delivering a TED Talk in July 2012. Born colorblind, he wears a prosthetic device called an eyeborg.
Is this an electronic eye? It's a color sensor that detects the color frequency in front of me and sends this frequency to a chip installed at the back of my head, and I hear the color in front of me through the bone, through bone conduction.
His senses of sight and hearing swirl around together like a symphony. Red, orange, and yellow are higher up the scale. Blues sit down low.
When I started to dream in color is when I felt that the software and my brain had united.
So that's human augmentation. Gartner predicts it'll be more than 10 years before it's a mature technology. A little further along the hype cycle, which means at this point it's getting more attention, is the concept of biochips. Gartner defines these as the merging of semiconductors with biology. Think simulated organs.
So this is actually the size of a memory stick or a rubber eraser. And then if you look closer, actually, you see these individual microfabricated channels in which we, you know, grow human cells.
Inside a UPenn lab, engineering professor Dan He shows off his lung-on-a-chip device. Using a syringe, he keeps the cells alive inside these little tubes with a mixture of nutrients and oxygen. It doesn't function like an actual lung, but it is in some ways an avatar for the air sacs within the lung. The chip itself is made of the same material as contact lenses.
And then because the device is flexible, we can actually compress or stretch the whole device to mimic asthma attack.
By recreating constricted airways, Huss says pharmaceutical companies could test the next generation of asthma drugs in a controlled setting rather than on animals or in petri dishes. There's real potential here. And that means, according to Gartner's chart, the technology will soon slide into the next part of the hype cycle. It's called the peak of inflated expectations. Right now, that dubious honor, the unrelenting but undeserved spotlight, shines brightly on the so-called Internet of Things. On the chart, it is right at the apex of hype. Dan Frommer, tech editor for the digital news site Quartz, explains that Internet of Things is all about hooking up everyday objects to the web.
The jokes are always about things like connected toasters or connected refrigerators. And, you know, when you think about it, a connected refrigerator isn't actually a horrible idea. How many times are you at the grocery store and wondering, oh, what's actually in my fridge right now? Do we have yogurt or not?
But Gartner argues all the chatter about futuristic refrigerators isn't actually a good thing for getting futuristic refrigerators. We're just not there yet. When you're at the peak of inflated expectations, it's like everyone is trying to jump on a bandwagon that can't yet handle the weight. Dan Frommer from Quartz says he tries to get his reporters to tamp down the hype for new products. But he still does more or less like the concept of the hype cycle.
Sure. I think it's an interesting document. It doesn't really, you know, it's not something that I necessarily sit around waiting for.
It's actually unclear who does eagerly await this chart's update each year, though the safe bet is billionaires. Hung Le Hong says most who buy the $7,500 version of the Hype Cycle report, which includes detailed analysis of each innovation, are entrepreneurs, large companies, and perhaps hedge funds. People actually doing the ground floor research and development, the grunt work, may simply glance at the one-page synopsis found for free online. And if they did, expect a few broken hearts when they learn their once-hot technology has now passed through the peak of inflated expectations. The next phase on the hype cycle is a sad, sad little world Gartner calls the trough of disillusionment. Like a B-list celebrity, technologies down in this deep valley may linger for years, their buzz reduced to a fading echo. Venture capital has moved on. Media has moved on. All that's left are the true believers, working to refine and improve the concept, to develop the second and third generation versions that will someday provide real-world benefit. Hung Le Hong calls one out.
We perceive there being negative hype in the marketplace today for cloud computing.
Along with the cloud, Gartner thinks big data and virtual reality are also feeling some serious growing pains. But they need not worry. The sun will soon peek through on the horizon.
And then, of course, there's a third phase, which is it crawls out of that deep valley and levels off. And at that point, that's where industry, enterprises, government, consumers get a very good grasp of where this technology works and, I guess, even more importantly, where it doesn't work.
This part of the cycle is divided into two sections. The slope of enlightenment, home right now to technologies including 3D scanners and gesture control, and then the final leg, the plateau of productivity.
Microphone on. Press Alt Tab. Move mouse up.
Speech recognition has the plateau all to itself on the latest hype cycle. Elliot Spindell shows it off.
Press enter. Microphone off.
An accident at home in 1985 left Spindell a quadriplegic. So being able to talk to his computer and have it understand him is pretty crucial. 20 years ago, still working to restart his life, he decided to learn how to write software code.
But at the time, I had to have somebody type for me, because I had no way to input into a computer. So I would basically dictate, and you would type.
This is right when the first versions of speech recognition software were coming out. It was revolutionary, he says, especially for people living with physical disabilities. But it didn't work all that well.
Like you would say, today is Tuesday, period. And now you can just, so you just say, today is Tuesday, period.
The technology has come so far since the mid-90s that Spindell now does back-end website work for a few nonprofits out of his residence at the Inglis facility in West Philly. Watching him code, though, it still appears slower than being able to type. Or maybe not.
It's hard to say. Before my injury, I was a two-finger kind of guy. And so it definitely was not much speed there.
Speech recognition is now more than simply controlling your mouse and keyboard with your voice. Apple's Siri and Google's Voice Search, they use algorithms to interpret, to learn, and ideally predict our queries. That used to be hype. It was inflated expectation. Today, it's real. Gartner, by the way, doesn't always nail that evolution. One big miss in recent times were tablets, which the chart predicted would take much longer to reach enlightenment than they did. This is not a perfect science, but it is a good visual reminder that innovators and their ideas rarely have a smooth journey on the road to commercialization. They face ups and downs, peaks and troughs, as they snake their way towards success. For The Pulse, I'm Todd Bookman.
Here's what I want you all to do for me.
Don't believe the hype. Don't believe the hype. Don't believe the hype.
Yes, was the start of my last jam, so here it is again, another death jam. But since I gave you all a little something that I knew you lacked, it's so consider me a new jack. All the critics you can hang on my hold the rope, but they hope to the Pope and pray it ain't dope. The follower of Farrakhan, he'll tell me that you understand until you hear the man. They'll book up the new school rap game. Writers treat me like Coltrane, insane. Yes to them, but to me, I'm a different.
You're listening to The Pulse. I'm Tanya English. Now a bit more forecasting. 2015 could be a landmark year for the environment. Delegates from nearly 200 countries will meet in Paris at the end of the year. Now, their plan is to hammer out the first worldwide emissions reduction agreement. The goal? To limit temperature increases to 2 degrees Celsius. That's the level scientists say will prevent the worst impacts of global warming. Carolyn Beeler charts some possible roadblocks on the road ahead.
Todos han leído el documento, lo han analizado.
Around 2 a.m. on Sunday, December 14th, exhausted-looking UN negotiators struck the closing gavel on the 20th UN Conference of the Parties in Lima, Peru.
I declare the 20th session of the Conference of the Parties closed.
After more than 36 hours of straight negotiating, the delegates had reached a breakthrough, a blueprint for the first deal committing every country in the world to reduce fossil fuel emissions. The Lima Accord requires countries to set their own goals for emissions cuts and report them to the international community in what's been called a name and shame agreement rather than a formal treaty.
The Lima Accord was largely about keeping all the countries on the table by creating a very broad and general framework that they could all agree to.
That's former Clinton climate advisor Paul Bledsoe, who was in Lima for the conference.
The amount of work to do ahead of Paris is immense and is going to take really nonstop negotiation over the next year.
Those negotiations will center around a handful of key sticking points. One is how the international community will monitor and verify whether countries are actually reducing emissions as much as they promise.
The Chinese, for example, have indicated a deep unwillingness to open up their heavy industry to verification by inspectors. So that's one issue that's going to be very difficult.
This debate turns on member nation sovereignty and how much a government is willing to submit its authority to international oversight. The citizens' climate lobby's Joseph Robertson guesses not all that willing.
Since no one really thinks there's going to be an international, you know, emissions police force, and I don't think anyone's arguing for that seriously, the question is, how aggressive do you have to be in the treaty language to get all of the major emitters to actually demonstrate what they're doing?
A second potential roadblock, Paul Bledsoe says, is who will pick up the tab for climate change adaptation and green development for poorer countries.
Countries have claimed that they are going to create a $100 billion annual green climate fund to deal with these issues starting in 2020. Right now, there are only about $10 billion in pledges. So that's a key issue of contention.
Financing is a primary negotiating concern for the 48-country bloc called the Least Developed Countries. Think Bangladesh, Cambodia, and Ethiopia. They historically have done the least to cause climate change, but see its effects the most, and the UN framework promises funds to help them combat rising seas and warming temperatures.
Pledges are made, but they aren't necessarily
delivered on time. And that's basically where the sticking point is.
Bangladeshi climate expert Salia Mul Haq serves as an advisor to the least developed countries bloc.
The rich countries who are making these pledges need to now deliver the money that they have promised.
The first week of meetings in Lima was dominated by conversations about who should get how much money, paid out by whom. Figuring out how to get governments and the private sector to pitch in could be the defining struggle on the pathway to Paris. Also at Lima, leaders decided not to mandate specific emissions cuts, but allow each country to submit its own targets. That, Paul Bledsoe says, leads to the third big negotiating issue.
Simply the size of the emissions cuts that are pledged by major countries.
Nations are required to submit their reduction targets by the end of March. In the following months, UN officials will crunch the numbers to see how global temperatures would fare if the plans were enacted. The agreed-upon goal is to limit warming to 2 degrees Celsius above pre-industrial temperatures. But even that fundamental fact, the least developed countries are challenging, says Haq.
The global agreement is 2 degrees, but the least developed countries are asking for 1.5 degrees. The difference between 1.5 degrees and 2 degrees is essentially, at 2 degrees, the rich save themselves. But at 1.5 degrees, that would apply to the whole world.
The least developed countries aren't getting any traction on this more stringent goal yet, but Haq says they won't give up. Today, even at the very beginning of the race to Paris, Paul Bledsoe thinks it will be a sprint to the finish, just like Lima was. However, bolstered by an early emissions pact between the U.S. and China, Bledsoe does think global leaders will sign an agreement in the end.
And the reason is that I think international pressure is going to be withering on any country or group of countries who try to stop an agreement.
For The Pulse, I'm Carolyn Beeler.
Coming up, we head into a massive rare book collection. Inside, we'll check out a 500-year-old text that helped lay the foundation for modern medicine.
So now we're going to go up 2 levels into the cage.
Into the cage?
Don't worry. It's just a word for something that's locked up.
Next on The Pulse, here on WHYY.
Independence Blue Cross is proud to support WHYY's The Pulse. IBC believes in living like nothing can hold you down. But to live worry-free, you need someone to fall back on. With doctors and hospitals across the region, Independence Blue Cross is here to help. This year, you may be eligible for financial support designed to help you live fearless. More information at IBX.com or 1-800-ASK-BLUE. Independence Blue Cross. Live fearless.
Supporting WHYY's The Pulse, AstraZeneca promotes health and science education and disease awareness through initiatives such as the Young Health Program, which helps young people build personal qualities to live healthy, successful lives. Launched in the U.S. in partnership with the United Way of Delaware, the Young Health Program has reached nearly 12,000 young people since 2012. More about the Young Health Program can be found online at im40.org.
Welcome back to The Pulse. I'm Tanya English. So it's the New Year's show, and we've been looking ahead. But sometimes to move ahead, you need to pause and look back. Alana Gordon is with us in the studio, and she wants to rewind a bit. Hey, Alana.
Hey, Tanya. I was thinking 500 years.
Okay, why 500 years?
Well, if we rewind that far back, we get to a moment, to Andreas Vesalius, actually, and his book that really helps set the stage for modern medicine. He hits the scene in the 1500s.
Well, it was an extraordinary time because it was really the time of the scientific revolution.
That is Jackie Bowman. She's director of education at the College of Physicians in Philadelphia. That's where the Mutter Museum is.
There was a whole birth of this generation of people who were really examining the world around them.
What was happening in those years, there was a perfect storm.
This is Dr. Sal Mangione. He's a pulmonologist and professor of history and physical diagnosis at Thomas Jefferson University's Medical School.
It's a transition period, okay? So the Renaissance is coming to an end. You have some very interesting personalities.
Like Copernicus, you know, establishing that the Earth and other planets rotate around the sun.
That was pretty amazing.
And you had the creation of universities to foster these ideas. Italy, where Dr. Mangione is from, it's a hub for this. And on top of all of that,
Gutenberg had invented the printing press.
And you had books being published about plants, about animals. This was the time of the Atlas.
So it's amid all of this, Tanya, that we get back to the main character of this story, Vesalius, who, by the way, just turned 500.
Okay, happy birthday to him. And who was he?
Well, I asked several medical students if they knew who he was. They didn't either. But Dr. Mangione and Bowman, they say Andreas Vesalius is an important guy that we should all know about.
Vesalius gives the beginning of medicine.
He really was the founder of modern anatomy.
By giving us, in many ways, the very first course that medical students study when they come to school, which is anatomy.
So Vesalius is born in 1514 in Brussels. He's from a very well-to-do family.
The father was the pharmacist to Charles V.
Vesalius then goes to Italy, to the University of Padua, to study.
Vesalius came when Padua was the Harvard of the time.
And right after he graduates, he's young, he's in his early 20s, he becomes a professor there. And it's in that role that he apparently really shakes things up. Now, I want to bring in Beth Lander. She's a librarian, also at the College of Physicians with Bowman.
I think it may be safe to refer to him as a bit of a rebel. He liked to do things his own way.
Vesalius was actually pretty short physically. He was thought to have some form of dwarfism. But what he did, Tanya, was big. He dissected cadavers, and he didn't just have students watch. They participated.
Okay, wait a minute. Isn't that what all medical students do?
Not at that time. Mangione says Vesalius was really the first one to bring human dissection into the classroom on a large scale.
Before Vesalius, they were looking at books, assuming that the information in the books was correct.
And the books they were looking at, they were from more than 1,000 years before, by this guy Galen. And Galen's teachings, they weren't even directly based on human anatomy, because during that time, 200 AD, dissecting humans really wasn't cool with the Greeks or the Romans.
So he relied on doing dissections of dogs and cats and lots of apes.
And he was incorrect because he hadn't dissected too many human beings. He was dissecting mostly animals.
But around the time of Vesalius, the church was starting to open up. So Vesalius, he brings in a lot of cadavers into the lab, examines them with students, but he doesn't rely on Galen's animal-based models to guide the lessons. So what happens?
He actually proves that Galen was wrong.
I mean, it's said that he found at least 200 mistakes that Galen had made.
Galen presumed, I think, 5 nodes of the liver, and Vesalius corrected that.
The mandible. Galen thought it was 2 different bones.
And once you prove that somebody untouchable like Galen is actually wrong, then the whole thing collapses.
And again, this is the time of the printing press. So Vesalius, in 1543, he's not even 30 yet. He publishes his findings.
It's called the Fabrica.
It was the first real anatomy textbook.
It literally means factory. But I think what he was talking about is the machine.
The human machine.
And it really changed the way physicians from then on have thought about the human body.
The book, it's over 600 pages.
I mean, it is a massive book.
It's a big book.
It's probably over 3 inches thick.
The Fabrica, it's divided into different sections.
It's neurologic, a little bit of muscles.
With each one peeling back another layer of the body.
I just love the skeletons.
And Vesalius, as he's writing this, he had an artist at his side. So it includes hundreds of really stunning woodcut illustrations of the human body.
It's amazingly beautiful.
They're often posed in very human ways, set against quaint Italian landscapes.
With the trees and the little villa, the river.
The College of Physicians has an original edition from 1543.
It is one of the things that when I first started working here, I took off the shelf in silence, opened it, and kind of bowed before it. Because as a librarian and as a book freak, it is just an extraordinary thing to behold.
So I've seen this book, and it is gorgeous. The Mütter Museum has it out on display as part of a special anatomy exhibit. But as accurate as he was for that time, Vesalius doesn't get it all right. He actually makes a bunch of mistakes. Ladies, he does not get the female reproductive system. But look, he's trying to break out of a mold of what he and other doctors have been trained to accept and see for hundreds of years. That's not easy. And it's actually in that process, that struggle even, that Dr. Mangione says lies Vesalius's real legacy.
He's the first to say the emperor has no clothes.
He helps establish this whole notion of skepticism in science.
So I think what Vesalius does in many ways teaches us that things that we take for granted as absolutely true, in reality they may not be.
Mangione thinks about this a lot as he teaches physical diagnosis to new students. He asks them to look beyond what they're taught to see to what they're really observing.
I would tell medical students that the magic word in science is bullshit. I mean, you really have to challenge anything that comes before, and you have to demonstrate that indeed is accurate.
Now, when Vesalius does this and challenges centuries of accepted knowledge, he faces a lot of backlash from the medical establishment. So much so that he supposedly burns his notes and drops out of academia. Then in 1564, Tanya, he dies in a shipwreck.
Wow, that's an incredible contribution to medicine. And it sounds like Vesalius still has a big legacy. And you got to see some of that a year ago, right?
I did. Last year, I went to Rowan School of Osteopathic Medicine in New Jersey, and I shadowed first-year medical students going through their first-ever anatomy lab.
Nice. Let's replay that piece.
It's a Friday afternoon, and some 75 bright-eyed first-year med students, most in their early 20s, are about to meet the very first patient of their formal medical training.
I'll be interested to see, like, how emotional I'll be.
Frances Ding doesn't know what kind of doctor she wants to be, but says today marks a turning point.
I think, like, you get into medical school and you're, like, convinced that you want to do it, but until you've had that experience, it's really hard to be, like, 100% sure.
For Megha Mandalewala, a lot of buildup to this day came from family.
Even in India, my uncles, who were doctors in India, said, like, that's, like, the first thing you do, you know? And, like, my parents, when they found out I was going to med school, they're like, oh, when does anatomy lab start? Like, that was the first thing they asked. Because they know that that's how you learn. Like, the body is so fundamental.
She peeked in the lab yesterday just to scope it out and prepare herself.
I'm, like, a little bit nervous, but I mean excited. But at the same time, like, you have to understand, like, it's weird that we get excited about these things, I think. Like, you know, it's a weird emotion to have. Like, most people don't get excited to see, like, a dead body, so to speak.
It's going to be pretty intense.
Samuel Werner, an aspiring primary care doctor, is steps away from entering the lab.
There's an overwhelming presence that there are dozens of vessels which once carried souls within that room. And no matter how we dismantle them, you can't hide what their original purpose was.
All right, so here we go. We're walking into the lab now, so...
Yeah, everyone looks so, like, official and, like...
This is, like, our first time, like, actually wearing scrubs for... not for fun. So this is, like, extra official, like, walking in.
Hey, guys!
The first thing that hits you in here is the smell. The lab is large and mostly bare, but reeks of embalming chemicals. About a dozen bodies wrapped in cloth and plastic rest on metal tables. The heads and almost everything else are completely covered, except for the chest cavity. Totally exposed, wide open, bleeding shades of bright burgundies and browns. The lab has two sessions. Students in the alternating one had already made the first incisions, peeling back the skin. Werner, Mandalewala, and Ding break off into different groups, with five students per table. Today's assignment? Removing and examining the heart.
It's very lumpy.
Slimy, too.
Like, in textbooks, you know, everything has a very defined shape. That is not the case at all. Everything, I feel like, kind of is the shape it is to fit in the body. Oh my god. Okay, they're going to cut the phrenic nerve.
Call it adrenaline, youthful science lab excitement, or future doctor instincts kicking in. Okay. Whatever apprehension Ding and others had going in, gone.
He's cutting the rib right now so we can have more space to actually go into the cavity. Okay, there you go. That's an interesting sound.
The only information students get about their bodies is the age, cause of death, and the sex. That's it. No names. But Rocco Carcia, Rowan's longtime anatomy teacher, says students will get to know them very well.
The way we approach it here, we make the cadaver their first patient. And so everything that goes along with that, the uncertainties, they learn secrets about the cadaver that probably the patient themselves never really realized.
Carcia doesn't lead any part of the class. Instead, he walks around, checking in as students take charge. The point is for them to integrate what they learn here into their clinical development. Werner and others focus on removing the heart without disrupting other important nerves and parts of the body. It's an art.
Right now, we will be exposing the inside of the ventricle.
Does it seem like a healthy heart?
Yeah, I mean, the patient was 107 years old, and the patient is in pretty incredible shape at the moment of death.
Over the next 2 hours, students peel back layers, trying to identify and understand all the different chambers and arteries. I catch one woman gasp as she first lays eyes on the intricate tree branch-like patterns of the heart muscles. As the three-hour lab comes to a close, Mandalay Wala and others provide, in some ways, the only real care they can to the bodies.
Can we get another paper towel right around here?
Redressing and wrapping them up.
There you go.
Spraying them with fluids to preserve them. It's intimate. Then they filter out and debrief.
Finally, it feels like I'm in med school, you know?
Ding says the experience has been validating.
I'm kind of surprised to see how easy I was able to kind of dissociate like the task of what I was doing from like the person, the patient.
I was literally holding in my hands a human heart. Not only a human heart, but a heart that belonged to a human.
Werner is still processing, thinking about how the experience is changing his view of his own mortality and choices.
I could see reflected in my hands the life that she chose to lead. Once you hold that, how can you not, moving forward, enter into a new life where you won't consciously be thinking about what choices you make will have on the physical reality around you?
After the year-long course comes to a close this spring, the donated bodies are cremated and returned to their families. Students will hold a memorial service where they'll read essays, recite poetry to honor those who donated their bodies. But for now, in what was just moments ago a booming room full of life and energy, these bodies rest, wrapped up, waiting till next class to serve as silent teachers for this next generation of doctors. For The Pulse, I'm Alana Gordon.
Coming up, it's not you, it's your diet.
I tried the South Beach diet that failed, and I tried doing exercising on an exercise bike for a half hour a day until that broke.
Still to come on The Pulse here on WHYY.
Independence Blue Cross is proud to support WHYY's The Pulse and believes that everyone should make the most of every moment. That's why they offer doctors and hospitals across the region and a range of health plans designed to meet your needs. More at IBX.com. Independence Blue Cross. Live fearless.
Actively supporting nonprofit organizations to increase disease awareness, prevention, and access to medicines in the Philadelphia region, AstraZeneca supports WHYY's The Pulse. Learn more by visiting AstraZeneca-US.com.
Ben Franklin Technology Partners of Southeastern Pennsylvania supports WHYY's The Pulse and are partners with a purpose, providing capital, counsel, and connections to technology entrepreneurs and investors in the greater Philadelphia area. More about Ben at partnerswithapurpose.org.
Welcome back to The Pulse, stories at the heart of health, science, and innovation. I'm Tanya English. Each January, we make guesses about the people and things we think you'll be talking about in the new year. Our first pick is the idea that entire neighborhoods, homes, workplaces, and some laws should be deliberately designed to promote health. experts use the phrase health in all policies. So the term is pretty esoteric, but the influence of public health is all around. Often, though, it goes unnoticed. It's quiet until it isn't. That's what health in all policies sounds like. It's the smoke detector in your home. In your car, it's that alarm that dings when you forget to put your seatbelt on. There are rules against smoking in public places. Lead paint is banned in homes. Those are obvious public health protections. Now there are debates about all sorts of other things that might matter to your health, from playgrounds to farmers markets, even the number of trees on your block. George's Benjamin leads the American Public Health Association.
We think that if we really want to make a difference in health, it all cannot happen just within the health sector itself.
It turns out that what happens in hospitals and at the doctor's office contributes a relatively small amount to good health. Public health people say the other part of the equation includes things like the neighborhood where you live, the food you eat, and how you get to work each day. But critics worry that regulating those things is expensive.
Yeah, well, we hear that, and we hear about that a lot, because what often happens is the health people get brought in too late in the project. You know, when they're about to lay the concrete, it's not the time to get involved in a project or where they've already drawn up the plans.
Benjamin says it's important to tally up not just the upfront cost of a public health policy, but to also count up the savings that may come down the road. If you're designing a street, for example, adding a bike lane is extra money. But Benjamin says there's also a healthcare cost when a cyclist zips in and out of traffic and gets hit by a car. Society saves money when pedestrians can cross the road safely.
We don't see health in all policies as tying anyone's hands.
Physician Linda Rudolph is with the Public Health Institute.
I was in a meeting recently with people from a number of different agencies where the planners had developed a plan for a light rail station. And when the health and public works folks looked at the plan, it was quickly evident that there was no way for bicycles to easily get to the train station.
Skeptics say that concept, health in all policies, can go too far when advice from public health gets codified and hard-baked into the law. For proof, Walter Olson looks back 100 years to Prohibition.
I have a tremendous quibble with it in that I think that Prohibition was a disastrous experiment that the country should never have entered.
Olson is with the libertarian think tank, the Cato Institute. He says Prohibition was partly sold as a public health measure. It was supposed to prevent illness, curb violence, but the national ban on alcohol had some unintended consequences, such as bathtub gin and bootlegging.
I'm a reformed prohibitionist myself. I hoped it was going to work. I'm forced to admit that it has not.
Doctors are not the only ones that we need to listen to, and sometimes we want the freedom to lead our lives, even in ways that may not follow doctors' orders.
Olson says there are lots of modern-day equivalents. He's pretty dubious about New York City's ban on supersized drinks, and he's iffy about those mandatory nutrition labels at fast food restaurants. Those solutions are too simple, Olson says, to fix our very complicated obesity problem, and they just might have some unimagined consequences. Whether you're with the public health people or part of the backlash, just you wait. We think you'll be talking about health in all policies in 2015. You're listening to The Pulse. I'm Tanya English. When the federal government asked doctors to digitize their medical records, some physicians started filling out those electronic forms right in the exam room during the office visit. That change sometimes places a computer between you and your doctor. But in the last decade, a possible solution and a new job title has emerged. Katie Davis reports.
Inverted T-wave and lead 3 in AVF.
Dr. Puneet Chopra is moving from patient to patient in the emergency room at Doctors Community Hospital in Lanham, Maryland. His scribe, Susan Kim, is right behind him pushing a cart with a computer. She's been trained to document everything that happens in the exam and mark the electronic form in her computer.
It's like a list of every bodily system, so like neurological or cardio or respiratory, and then there's like different symptoms, and you either circle it if they have the symptom or you cross it out if they don't have it.
After the exam, there is a quick exchange in the hallway to clarify the diagnosis.
There's scleral icterus on her. Everything else about her exam is completely normal. Under skin, you can put, is there like a color under skin, under your normal skin?
No.
Hit other and just put in jaundice.
Dr. Chopra is 36, old enough to have seen huge changes in how doctors practice medicine. Before using scribes, he would have juggled his stethoscope and computer. He would have broken eye contact while typing. After the exam, he would have spent a few minutes writing in more details.
In the old days, you spent a lot of time at the patient's bedside, and now the common saying is that you spend more time with the computer and you're sitting in the room typing away while you're trying to talk to this patient and examine them. And they don't even feel, the patient doesn't feel like it's a personal encounter anymore.
Scribes to the rescue. They sit in a corner, they say nothing, and document the conversation between patient and doctor. And they earn between $10 and $25 an hour.
They are a member of the healthcare team. It's a physician and scribe, we'll see you now type of model.
That's Dr. Michael Murphy, co-founder and CEO of Scribe America. He says there are about 10,000 scribes working in the country, about half trained by his company. Dr. Murphy says in some situations, however, patients choose not to have a scribe in the room.
OBGYN practices and urology, in those kind of intimate settings, we get a digital mic that the physician has. They put it on their lapel coat and let them know that the encounter is going to be recorded. The scribe will sit outside the room, but they can hear everything.
A lot of information in many hands, and computers can be hacked. Retired cardiologist Dr. Joel Sherman of Connecticut is worried about the patient's privacy. He blogs about it on the healthcare website kevinmd.com. Here he is.
You know, a GP is going to ask about sexual history, drugs, all kinds of things that you would be inhibited from talking about. Other problems with scribes, some of them are just basically high school kids with a few months of training. They have no experience in medicine.
Doctors who use scribes say they can cut 2 hours out of clerical work and see several more patients in that time. In Philadelphia, a hospital cut their wait time for appointments from 1 to 2 months down to a week. Medicine is not all math, though. It is listening between the lines and then distilling a problem. So hospitals and doctors will have to decide whether a scribe helps them do that or interferes with that relationship. For The Pulse, this is Katie Davis.
1, 2, 3, 4.
Yes, sir, all night, will you read my book? It took me years to write, will you take a look? It's based on a novel by a man named Lear, and I need a job, so I want to be a paperback writer.
This is The Pulse on WHYY. I'm Tanya English. If you're like lots of people, you're suffering a post-holiday food hangover after eating some combination of chocolate, ham, eggnog, and mashed potatoes. It's no big mystery, then, that New Year's resolutions often focus on dieting, or at least talking about it.
So my goal is actually to reach my ideal BMI.
Stop smoking, lose weight, make more money. Exercise, join the gym.
I plan to eat more vegetables and stick with chicken and fish, which I'm okay with.
The thing is to eat everything in moderation, even ice cream.
Psychologist Charlotte Markey is tired of the eating fads that sweep the nation every January. She's written a new book, Smart People Don't Diet, and she joins us here in the studio. Thanks for coming in.
Thanks so much for having me.
So your advice seems to be pick foods and eating habits that you really can keep up for your entire life. Is that it?
That's definitely it. We don't want people to do things that are just for the short term. We want people to think about the long term.
And why is the long term so important?
Well, I mean, I think most dieting approaches are very short-term, and they're catchy, they're fast, they're intended to be painless, but usually they don't actually work out that way. And people may lose weight, but they usually just gain it back. And that up and down of weight loss and weight gain can not just frustrate people, but can have some real negative consequences.
Negative how?
Well, I mean, I think emotional consequences can be very negative, right? That up and down. So it's hard not to feel like a failure if you gain all the weight back. And then even just metabolic and physical consequences can be pretty negative.
You talk about fad diets in the book. What's a fad diet? How do I know this is not the right one to choose?
Right. Well, I mean, I think most diets you've heard of are fad diets, probably. And it seems that the diets that are the most extreme and just the craziest get the most attention. And I think for people like me who study these issues empirically, it's just incredibly frustrating to watch people try the, you know, low-carb approach over and over again and just usually fail over and over again.
And what does the science say about that? We're mostly going to get that weight back?
Yeah. I mean, you know, after any given time on a diet, usually these studies look at about 2 years out. People have lost 0 pounds and oftentimes have gained weight. So the net result of going on most of these diets is to lose nothing or to gain weight. So, I mean, how can you possibly recommend that?
A lot of the diets that I've chosen in the past, it's like cut out a whole big category of food and just make that your forbidden food.
Right.
Does that mess with our heads?
Yeah. I mean, I think what it does is it just elevates those foods into foods we want that much more usually. And so, you know, if you say you can't have carbs, which has been just, you know, a longstanding trend now, then what do you want? You want bread. You want pasta. And it just seems to be psychologically a much more adaptive approach to say like, well, you know, maybe a lot of bread isn't a great idea. There's not a lot of nutritional value in some of it, perhaps. But I can have some of it sometimes. And once people get that more moderate mindset, they usually are much more successful in the long run.
One of your suggestions is that people record everything that they eat, very honestly, for only about a week.
Right.
How does that help?
Well, I think that a lot of times we're all in denial about what we really eat. And I will periodically do this as well. And I always surprise myself even, you know, how many little snacks you can have here or there, or, you know, the secretary at my work has, you know, candy in her office, how many times I grab a piece of that. Mm-hmm. So I think the first step needs to be just coming to terms with our habits. And once we come to terms with our habits, then we can gradually change them.
And the things that I drink count too? I have to count those up as well?
Yeah, I mean, drinks are the easiest way to lose weight usually, just changing what we drink. I mean, most of us are not drinking probably enough water. So it's just such a simple way to drop out a few hundred calories a day for many people.
Let's talk about husbands and wives. So
yes.
I am married to a Midwest guy, a big one who loves cheeseburgers.
Right.
And I love him and I want to spend time with him, and we end up spending time eating cheeseburgers together.
Right.
How can I stop that from happening?
Well, you know, it's tricky because we tend to adopt the eating habits of the people that we spend time with. And it's also really tricky to figure out how to have this conversation with your partner without completely insulting them. So I do think it's important to tread carefully and maybe just to say, hey, I love you and we both love cheeseburgers. But if we want to be around eating cheeseburgers for a long time, then maybe we should only do it once a week. A lot of my research has actually looked at romantic partners and eating behaviors and body image, and we know that we're influencing each other, and communicating about this stuff may feel like navigating a landmine, but it doesn't mean that it can't be done. In fact, in some of my research, we force couples to sit down and talk about these issues. And when we started doing this, we thought, oh my gosh, they're going to fight and people are going to be throwing things. This is really risky what we're doing here. And a lot of times at the end of it, they thank us because no one's ever given them the opportunity to just sit down and say, listen, we really should eat better, or I love you so much just how you are, but I'm worried about your health or my health.
So you're telling us not to diet, but isn't telling us not to diet kind of a diet plan in itself?
Yeah, that's sort of a trick question, but you're right. I mean, I think that people do need to do something. We are dealing with pretty staggering rates of obesity in this country. Mm-hmm. So it's not to say that my approach suggests just do nothing, eat whatever you want all the time. But what I really am trying to present is a different way to think about these issues. So not to think about them in the short term and not to think about it as just fast and easy and something that you can do for a week or a month, but just think about it as your life, right? What do you want to do for the rest of your life that will be healthy and, you know, hopefully leave you lighter as well?
Charlotte Markey's book is Smart People Don't Diet. Thank you and Happy New Year.
Happy New Year to you too.
That's our show for this week. The Pulse is a production of WHYY in Philadelphia. Our health and science reporters are Carolyn Beeler, Alana Gordon, and Todd Bookman. Charlie Kyer is our engineer, Joel Patterson, the associate producer. Megan Pinto is our executive producer. And we had special help this week from Laura Benchoff and Naomi Starobin. Chris Cetullo is vice president of news. Christine Dempsey is our chief content officer. If you missed some of today's show or any of our previous shows, you can subscribe to our podcast on iTunes or at our website, whyy.org/thepulse. And we really want to hear from you. Email us with your feedback at thepulse@whyy.org. I'm Tanya English. Host Mike and Scott is back next week. Mike and we missed you. Thanks for listening.
Thanks again. Thanks again. Thanks again. Thanks again.